Accession number 10613, Reel 2.
Major Charles, Burden Taylor, Reel 2. You were telling me about the shooting at Stanley Drill Hall.
Oh, yes. We used to have a number of small bore matches. That was in the normal training anyway, prior to going on the open ranges. But we also used to shoot against local clubs, including the police and so on. But we were talking about that sort of attitude towards the lads. And this may sound a stupid example, but I recall we used to have a brazier to heat up the rifle range, which was very cold in winter. And if you were really going to get all pompous and say, Lance Corporal Snooks, you get in there and fix that, then you would probably get it fixed. But it would probably be very smoky and minimal heat. But if you said, well, Lance Corporal Snooks, look, we've got the police coming next week. It's going to be a needle match. Now get everything absolutely fixed up the way you usually do, then that would give you double service than you would get than if you were going to be, what can I say, terribly pompous and terribly insular. We were talking about this relationship that we had between ourselves and ourselves.
You had to, in a sense, besides, one of the ways of gaining the respect of your men was to respect them and their abilities and their role in things.
Absolutely right, yep. I think that was of prime importance, to really understand the relationship that's got to be built up to gain the mutual confidence. And the mutual confidence, I mean that. It's got to be mutual.
How did you get on with your NCOs? How important were they to you?
They were absolutely... Well, it is said, of course, that the warrant officers and NCOs are the backbone of the British Army. And I think that has got to be... It might not be literally true, but by gosh, there's a tremendous amount of it is true from the point of view that they, certainly at that time, invariably were older than I was, much more experienced. And as an example, if one was to give a simple order, which you thought was perhaps right, they could adjust that, knowing full well that what you'd really ordered, knowing what you wanted, knowing what had to be done. But this youngster, you know, hasn't quite got it right. But we know what he needs, and would see it through. And I think that's the main thing. And for that matter, this question of mutual confidence building, I think that was perhaps the most important thing. Because if you didn't get the support of your NCOs, if you didn't deserve the support, then you could find yourself in fair queer street.
What did you think the division of roles was between an officer and an NCO? In peacetime, you know, I really mean before the war. Where did your role end and their role begin, and why weren't they officers? I mean, that's a silly way of putting it. But yeah. What was it that you, as officers, were meant to provide that they couldn't?
This is a very difficult one. I would say that one's got to perhaps work from the top, and by that one might say the country, and then the War Office, and then through all the various commands and corps and down to battalion level and then down to company and platoon level, and then you started switching between the officer and the soldier. I think that his role was perhaps like any of the above, to interpret what was necessary to create and continue an efficient working body. I think the officer has got very much wider, not so much powers, but he's got a certain amount of greater flexibility. One hates to say he's got a greater education, because that's always a matter of opinion, because there are many people who may have had a modicum of education, who have risen to the top and been tremendous leaders. But I think that the other thing is perhaps that he's got to be a slight sort of totem pole, and somebody who you can go to and talk to and gain sympathy from when it's necessary.
I think, yes, that's clear enough. Now, when you went to Stanley Drill Hall, what would the routine be on a typical night? How was the evening organised, as far as you were concerned, as a platoon, yeah.
Well,
commander?
Yeah, I think that throughout the year, your training was started really from basic. In other words, simply being a soldier. You had to be able to shoot. You had to be able to conceal yourself. You had to be able to move across country, interpret the country, so that you could move without being spotted. You then had to work as a first team, which would be the section, about 8-9 men. Then you'd get on to platoon training, where three sections would work together with the platoon headquarters. And so that built up to company training, and then you'd go to camp and have battalion training. So that what you got really was that was throughout the year. That would have led up to the camp in the summer, and started really in round about November time, where you really started again to regain.
So what would happen on any one evening would depend at which stage in the
rolling right.
program you
yes.
were.
Yep. It could be talking. It could be going into a local bit of farm field that you'd borrowed, hired, or you know, talk the farmer into letting you have to do a little bit of concealment and camouflage, or it could be a lecture on other arms. What do the gunners do? What do the engineers do? But that would be later on in the year.
And how long would you be at the drill hall?
I think officially it was something from 7:30 to 9:30, but I don't think ever did we stick to that rule at all. We were always there for a little bit extra, and also Sundays quite often, as we'll come to later, I think, on the question when I was given the carrier platoon, I couldn't stop the lads coming. And that's all extra, not paid.
How were relationships with the other officers?
Well, I've got to say normal, I suppose, but except that I recollect that might have been my age at the time, but we rather regarded your captains, who were company commanders, or the adjutant was a captain as well, whereas nowadays they are majors. Three pips were quite a great deal higher than just one pip, and so that one had a pretty healthy respect for anyone who had three pips or above. And I must add, I may say, that one had a pretty healthy respect too for the senior subaltern. That's a senior lieutenant with his two pips.
What was his role as senior?
Well, we used to have periodic meetings, which I suppose were partially social, because we used to have them in a restaurant in Newcastle. And I think it was really the time to have ideas that might be passed down, I would say, possibly from the colonel, some ideas that he may have relative to officers, which are far better put over verbally than put in, shall we say, an order. Also, if we'd possibly had one or two naughty boys, or I can't think what we necessarily would have done it to be naughty at that time, but if anyone had reduced the standard, shall we say, in some way, and it come to the notice of the senior subaltern, then it might be brought up at these meetings. Or for that matter, he might at any time ring up and say, look, so-and-so happened, and this is just not on, letting the team down. But it was a very good, I think a very good scheme. It was social, it was friendly. You didn't feel that if you were ticked off that you really criminal. But it just meant that you kept your standard up.
At these meetings, then, you were allowed to talk shop, to exchange information and...
Oh, yes, yes. At the subaltern's meetings. Yep.
And was it a valuable way of exchanging sort of things you learned? Did people, was it actually useful to you as a very young officer to...
Because one additional factor, of course, if you think that the various company drill halls were spread throughout the Durham County, this was one time when all subaltern officers would get together. And, of course, from the point of view of, you could say, also exchanging ideas, because when you had your drills, then you went individually to your individual drill halls. And then the other time that you would be got together would be possibly a training session which might be called by the colonel or the 2IC or even the adjutant for that matter, and we might all congregate in the mess in Durham. It would be another time to get together, same when we went to camp on the annual camp.
I'll come to the annual camp. Did the officers socialise together in any other ways? I mean, not just the subalterns, were there any other social meetings?
No, I think that on the question, when you mentioned, not related to camp necessarily, I mean, we had, obviously we went out to other battalions, would ask us, or some of us, to their regimental dinner night. We in turn would invite them over.
What were these regimental dinners? In camp, yeah.
Ah,
what were these regimental dinners?
Well, it was merely a more formal occasion than, I mean, most evenings anyway in those days, the standard was high, and one had a formal dinner each evening anyway. But shall we say that rather than going what we then called blues, we would go in mess kit.
What exactly was mess kit?
Well, that was the scarlet tight trews, Jemima boots, and the short jacket, the bum freezer, and what, white stiff shirt, black tie.
And what was the protocol of these dinners? Were there any sort of...
Well, it was... Yes, you assembled in the anteroom first and foremost for a few drinks before, and also to receive your guests and look after them, and then you'd move into the dinner, and from then on, really, it's a question of just, shall we say, getting on with the dinner and socialising on a verbal basis, and then there's the Mr. Vice, which would mean that the Vice President of the evening would be called upon to toast Her Majesty, and we would do that. And then we would withdraw to the anteroom after the meal.
This was your closest thing to a mess, then? The mess.
Oh, yes, yes, very much. This was a marquee, and they did have a partition at one end, which would, I suppose would be about a third of the marquee, was the anteroom, and the dining area was the rest, which with silver and mahogany tables and so on.
Did they play the sort of mess games that the regular regiment...
Yes, oh, yes.
What sort of games did they play?
Well, Monte Kitty... I think that's pretty well known.
Well, could you just describe it?
This is very difficult, but if you could imagine an armchair and where you're sitting, the fellow will bend over and put his head into the armchair, and they're split into two teams, obviously, and next person would stick his head between the first fellow's legs and so on, so that you've got a sort of caterpillar effect. And the opposition would then take a running jump to get as far on top of the caterpillar as possible, and so they followed on, shall we say there were seven each or something like that, and if they got seven on and we hadn't fallen down underneath, then he would say Monte Kitty, one, two, three, fingers or thumbs, and they had to say yes or, you know, gauge whether fingers or thumbs were up, and if they lost then they had to get down again. That was one of them.
Any others you remember?
I beg your pardon?
Any others you remember?
I remember one fellow, he, bless his heart, was killed, I think, with 16 DNI, but Fred Kirkup, when I mentioned this question of mess kit, the tight-fitting trews, and also which was strapped beneath the Jemima boots, but he could climb the tent pole and undress at the top of the tent pole and to bollock naked. I think he kept his underpants on, I can't remember, frankly, but to do that, I mean, it's difficult enough getting out of trews, shall we say, at the best of times, but after a fairly pleasant dinner and perhaps one or two drinks afterwards, this is a remarkable effort.
Any other games or pranks or traditions?
Have you interviewed Ian Pitt? We decided on our little... Everyone had to have a party piece at one time or another, but there's a stupid little song that I'm a little prairie flower growing wilder every hour. I can't remember the bits that came in between, but we used to sing that as a party piece. There were one or two rude songs, obviously, which came out from one or two people, but they developed onto really community singing, which was good fun because it's rather like the rugger songs, that type of thing. Offhand, if I recall any, I'll chip in.
Was there much drinking at such a do? Or was
not really. I don't think so. I don't think we really thought. Nowadays, with drink drive and worrying about getting home always having to have somebody to drive you home if you're going to have a fair skinful, that didn't apply. And in any case, you were really, certainly at camp, you were going really to your camp bed. In other times, the annual ball, no, I don't think that drink really came into conversation. We had our normal tipple, I think, that, shall we say, through a meal, you may have two wines. Well, you didn't drink a bottle each. You drank what really came up, what you felt like. So you didn't guzzle. And I don't think it's really a subject.
So people were merry rather than drunk?
Oh, that I would say for certain. Yes, really travelling on, when one thinks about how one got together with one's brother officers, and there were odd, what can I say, the civil side of life, because there's an annual ball held in Newcastle at what was then the Oxford Galleries, it's got another name now, but in New Bridge Street, which was the Army and Navy, and that was a most colourful affair, because you really had all services represented, and all, attached corps, other arms of the service, the gunners, the signals, and so on, in their own individual uniforms. And also, for that matter, although not necessarily on an officer's mess basis, we used to have all ranks dancers in the drill halls in the county. And, of course, at least the company officers went to those. It was a very, very good additional form of getting a relationship right with the lads without getting too involved. But I think it was a very human aspect. Also, for that matter, it used to make a fair amount for company funds, which went back to the lads in any case.
How did you get on with the officers from the 6th and the 9th?
The other two battalions in the brigade. Well, I better be careful what I say, but I think because they were relatively, what can I say, away from us. The 6th battalion rather occupied the southern part of the county. I think they were based on, or headquarters at Bishop Auckland. Whereas the 9th Battalion at Great Gateshead, which is north of the county, was Durham Middle. And a lot of the 8th Battalion officers, of course, lived in the Newcastle area, as did the 9th officers. So we got on perhaps a little better than we did with the 6th. The other side of the coin, of course, was that the 6th Battalion had black buttons. And rather loosely, we used to term the 6th Battalion in the pre-war days as those black button bastards, but nevertheless we invited them always to our mess dues, and they in turn of course invited us. And if one, sorry to just go on, but I gather that by the time we got during the war, I wasn't literally there, but in Sicily I think that by that time it was the 6th and 8th that got on terribly well, and the 9th was out on a limb. Or it might have been a different combination, but apparently the black button image had disappeared by this time.
With the relationship with the 6th, was it a serious dislike of their officers, or was it more a sort of traditional dislike?
Oh, no. I think it was just one of those things which, in fact, the BBB was probably, perhaps at the end of some night or an evening, somebody might have, crossed swords, verbally I mean, with someone relative to the 6th. And I think that is just, these things can start in the simplest of ways without any antagonism or anything like that being meant.
Do you remember any of the officers in particular from the 6th? Any come to mind?
Mike Ferrans. Yes, I meet him now. Higgins. There was another brother Ferrans for that matter. And two other brothers, I remember. But the names defeat me, but I am absolutely useless at remembering names.
What about Watson?
Oh, Willie Watson, late deceased too, which is a great pity. No, he was a bit older than me, and I'm still thinking in terms of pre-war times, and also he was tall and extremely straight. He held himself tremendously erect. I would say possibly I was slightly afraid of him in those days, but once you came to know him, then you found that he had a different side to him. But he was a bogeyman at first, as far as I was concerned. Not because he was 60 alive, mind you.
You mentioned the social side of camp. What else would you be doing at camp? The first one, I think, was at Whitby.
Yes, that's right. That was new to me. And I think basically what we had to do there was to take every opportunity of, A, having the battalion together and being able to work as a battalion and make full use of the training areas that were made available to us. And leading up to that, our training was really on a... We'd had platoon training back in our drill halls and the immediate environment. And occasionally, incidentally, we used to, throughout the year, we might go away for a weekend camp as a company and try and get over our platoon training and perhaps the odd company exercise. That would be followed up at camp by company exercises and also battalion exercises. In other words, making full use of the, shall we say, the bigger picture and the bigger areas which we could work over.
And what kind of thing were you doing in these exercises?
Well, basically, at that time, I was really leading my platoon. And that would be any action of war. It could be attacking an area, withdrawing from a... British Army doesn't retreat, but withdrawing from a particular point to practice the method of disengaging from the enemy. It could be patrols, small patrols, big patrols, fighting patrols, recce patrols, all of the basic training.
Did you have tutes while you were in camp, or would they be normally?
No, I don't remember tutes at camp, because I think that would be really rather a pity. We did tutes throughout the year on our home base, because basically all you needed to carry it as a tactical exercise without troops were the people that you wanted to go on a tut. And you could really do it from the side of the road. If you would understand that if you were doing an advance to contact or something like that, you didn't have to take 1,000 foot soldiers across country to do it. You could pretend, if you like, that they would go that route over the area, carry out an attack or whatever, and just move your group of officers or whoever is on the tute to from point to point. And you would do that by road.
And what exactly would you be doing? What sort of problem were you addressing?
It could be any sort of problem. If I think usually they had a theme. It could be basically, shall we say, if you were going to have a defence project or a defence tute, then you might start off at a certain point, and you'd be the directing staff would paint the picture that here you are a company commander or whatever, in a certain position, the enemy over the last few days has been doing this, that and the other, the situation is becoming untenable, and you are proposing to withdraw to another defensive position at so-and-so, so-and-so. Give your orders for this withdrawal, or something of that ilk.
And then would you discuss the various orders people had thought of, or...?
We'd go back to the point to where we're going to. We'd have perhaps... There may be 10 questions in a tut, and... we say after half an hour, having been given the question, then we'll meet up at such and such a point, and somebody, a spokesman from each group, would be asked to present his plan, and somebody else would be asked to comment. What do they think? And then the directing staff would say, well, we feel that the directing staff solution is this, but the merits of the others are so-and-so. So we'd all learn the lessons of whatever particular operation we're carrying out.
Now, in 1938, the carrier platoon was set up. Could you tell me about that?
Yep. This was something quite new, and what it amounted to is that a company, an infantry company at that time, was about 130 men and armed with rifles and three light machine gun Brens to each platoon, so there were 9 in the company. This carrier platoon was in fact 10 light armoured tracked vehicles, and each with 3 men, each with rifles and a Bren gun. So in actual fact you had from the point of view of Bren guns, you had tremendous firepower, more, in fact, than an infantry company, plus the fact that you were completely mobile and could dart in or dart out because you were entirely flexible. You were divided into 3 sections, and so your characteristics were mobility, high firepower to be used as and where necessary.
Were you involved in setting up the carrier platoon?
Yes, very much so. At that time, there wasn't a pamphlet. There was just a general, what can I say, understanding that you had one subaltern officer, one sergeant, I think three corporals of the section commanders, and a total of 32 people, and 10 carriers. And what we had to do with them, there wasn't a training manual at that time, so there was a splendid chap called Craggs, who in fact was enlisted overage into this time C Company, on which I was still based, and he was given sergeant's rank, a prisoner during the First War, but a real stalwart. And between us, by discussion and sorting out the characteristics which we had, we worked out how we would operate and use this new weapon.
And how did you think you were going to use it?
Well, we reckoned that it was a question of the high firepower was, shall we say, a deterrent anyway to any enemy. The mobility was there, so one could, in fact, use that high firepower, shall we say, in an attack by perhaps carrying out a mobile fire roll on the flanks to cover one's flanks, support by firepower the flanking area against the attack area to avoid being, if you like, surprised by a left hook or a right hook counterattack. The other side of the coin, one mustn't talk too much about withdrawal, but they were obviously very, very useful from the point of view of being able to leave high firepower behind and get out quickly, not a question of marching out and taking time and so on. The other side of the coin is really they could be used on, in a way, like light cavalry, like the light armoured cars, in other words, probing quietly forward and using cover, etc., etc., but trying to find out, to root out the enemy, and if one meets them, to be able to get away very quickly, but at the same time have that firepower to, if you like, give the impression that there's more there than the enemy might think.
What pattern were the carriers you were originally issued with? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't know. What pattern? I can only remember they had Ford V8 engines, which used to push up at very high revs. It's a very noisy thing, but on the other hand, they could...
What speed did they manage?
I get really almost a sort of shiver down the spine at times, because I remember driving one at about 50 miles an hour on a road, and the main point is that I had never thought of it at the time, but if I skidded off the road, this was before the war, then one could have landed upside down, and, you know, it could have been most unfortunate. Kill yourself if you feel like it, but I had three or four chaps with me.
So you and this Craggs were working
Markie,
on these tactics.
Markie Craggs. Yep.
Were you in touch with any of the other carrier platoons within the brigade to discuss the tactics?
No.
You were...
No, not at that time. So in fact, when I come to think of it, not at all. I think I don't remember when we ever got any paper on carrier platoons, because shortly after the war broke out, I handed over the carrier platoon to Ian English.
So did you write them down for your platoon?
Yeah. We had our little, what I might say, our little training manual.
And who were you attached to? Were you still... normally they were with the headquarters company. Is that where you were?
No, I think that what happened at that time, I was then out at C Company, and I had my infantry platoon, and then I was the next senior and would have been second in command of C Company. But then this business of the carrier platoon came up, and the colonel decided that it would be set up in Stanley, and a great thing, I was given basically the pick of anyone that I wanted, which was very kind, very helpful, because obviously we wanted some people of, you know, slightly higher average, because they'd have to make snappy decisions and so on. And so the carrier platoon was formed at Stanley as part of headquarter company attached, C Company Stanley.